you need not restrain. That's one of the things about the Krishna consciousness movement. You can let it all out and not feel embarrassed. Okay? So.
Jaya Radha Madhava Kunja Hari. Jai Radha Madhava Punjabi Hari Radha Madhava Punjabi Hari Jaya Gopi Janavallabha Girivardhari Jaya Gopi Janavallabha Girivardhari Yasoda Nandana Vrajana Ranjana Yasoda Nandana Vrajana Ranjana Nandana Vrajana Ranjana Tira Vanachari Yamuna Tira Vanachari Jaya Radha Madhava Punjabi Hari Jaya Radha Madhava Punjabi Hari Jaya Gopi Janavallabha Girivardhari Jaya Gopi Jaya Gopi Janavallabha Girivardhari Yasoda Nandana Vrajana Ranjana Yasoda Nandana Vrajana Ranjana Yamna Kira Vanachari Kira Vanachari Yamna Kira Vanachari Jaya Radha Madhava Punjabi Jaya Radha Madhava Punjabi Jaya Radha Madhava Punjabi Hari Radha Madhava Punjabi Jaya Gopi Janavallabha Girivardhari Jaya Gopi Janavallabha Girivardhari Yasoda Nandana Vrajana Ranjana Yasoda Nandana Vrajana Ranjana Yamuna Tira Vanachari Tira Vanachari Yamuna Tira Vanachari Hare Krishna, Krishna, Hari 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 Ramu Hari Ramu 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 Hari Hari Hare Krishna Hare Krishna 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 Hari 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 Ramu Hari Ramu 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 Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Ramu, Hare Ramu, Ramu Ramu, Hare Hare, Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Ramu, Hare Ramu, Ramu Ramu, Hare Hare. Jaya Prabhupada, Jaya Prabhupada, Jaya Prabhupada, Jaya Prabhupada. Jaya Prabhupada, Jaya Prabhupada. Jaya Prabhupada, Jaya Prabhupada. Prabhupada, 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 Jaya Jaya Prabhupada,
Jaya Prabhupada, 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 Jaya Jaya Prabhupada.
Jayam Vishnupad Paramahansa Parivajakacharya Astatara Sata Shri Shri Mahad. His Divine Grace A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Srila Prabhupada Ki Jaya. ISKCON Founder Acharya Srila Prabhupada Ki Jaya. Ananta Koti Vaishnava Vrinda Ki Jai Namacharya Srila Haridas Thakura Ki Jai Premsakahu Sri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Sri Advaita Gadadhara Sri Vasari Gaura Bhakta Vrinda Ki Jai Sri Sri Radha Krishna Gopa Gopinatha Shamakun Radhakund Gidi Govardhana Ki Jai Vrindavan Dhamma Ki Jai Mathura Dhamma Ki Jai Mayapo Navadvip Dhamma Ki Jai Jagannath Puri Dhamma ki jai, Ganga Mai ki jai, Yamuna Mai ki jai, Tulsi Devi ki jai, Bhakti Devi ki jai, Samaveda Bhakti Vrinda ki jai, Srila Prabhupada's Transcendental Book Distribution ki jai, Harinama Sankirtan ki jai, Prasadam Distribution ki jai, Samaveda Bhakti Vrinda ki jai, all glories to the assembled devotees, all glories to the assembled devotees. All glories to the assembled devotees. All glories to Sri Sri Guru and Gauranga. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Reading from Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 5, Chapter 9, Text Number 16. Now I notice that these texts are in prose form. In New Dwarka, we generally don't read the Sanskrit. We usually read the Sanskrit only for those which are verses, which have a poetic melody to them. Is that the system here? Okay. I just didn't feel I'm cheating any of you of some of the Sanskrit. So we'll go right into the translation. At this time, one of the thieves, acting as the chief priest, was ready to offer the blood of Jadbarat, whom they imagined to be an animal man, to the goddess Kali to drink as a liquor. He therefore took up a very fearsome sword, which was very sharp, and, consecrating it by the mantras of Bhadrakali, raised it to kill Judd Bharat. Please repeat. At this time, one of the thieves, acting as the chief priest, was ready to offer the blood of Judd Bharat, whom they imagined to be an animal man, to the goddess Kali, to drink as a liquor. He therefore took up a very fearsome sword, which was very sharp, and, consecrating it by the mantra of Bhadrakali, raised it to kill Judd Bharat. So there's no purport here. So we'll go on to the next translation. All the rogues and thieves who had made arrangements for the worship of Goddess Kali were low-minded and bound to the modes of passion and ignorance. They were overpowered by the desire to become very rich. Therefore, they had the audacity to disobey the injunctions of the Vedas, so much so that they were prepared to kill Judd Bharat, a self-realized soul born in a Brahmin family. Due to their envy, these dacoits brought him before the goddess Kali for sacrifice. Such people are always addicted to envious activities, and therefore they dared to try to kill Judd Bharat. Judd Bharat was the best friend of all living entities. He was no one's enemy, and he was always absorbed in meditation on whom? Well, you're reading it. That's cheating. Okay. Well, on the Supreme Personality of Godhead, he was born of a good Brahmin father, and killing him was forbidden, even though he might have been an enemy or aggressive person. In any case, there was no reason to kill Judd Bharat, and the goddess Kali could not bear this. She could immediately understand that these sinful dacoits are thieves, rogues, dacoits, were about to kill a great devotee of the Lord. Suddenly, the deity's body burst asunder, and the goddess Kali personally emerged from it in a body burning with an intense and intolerable effulgence. Purport by Srila Prabhupada. According to the Vedic injunctions, only an aggressor can be killed. If a person comes with an intent to kill, one can immediately take action and kill in self-defense. It is also stated that one can be killed if he comes to set fire to the house or to pollute or kidnap one's wife. Lord Ramchandra killed the entire family of Ravan because Ravan kidnapped his wife, and what was her name? What? Sita Devi, yes. However, killing is not sanctioned in the Shastras for other purposes. The killing of animals in sacrifice to the demigods, who are expansions of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, is sanctioned for those who eat meat. This is a kind of restriction for meat eating. In other words, the slaughter of animals is also restricted by certain rules and regulations in the Vedas. Considering these points, there was no reason to kill Judd Bharat, who was born in a respectable, highly exalted Brahmin family. He was a God-realized soul and a well-wisher to all living entities. The Vedas did not at all sanction the killing of Judd Bharat by rogues and thieves. Consequently, the goddess Bhadrakali emerged from the deity, from the form to give protection to the Lord's devotee. Srila Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur explains that due to the Brahman's effulgence, of such a devotee as Judd Bhadat, the deity was fractured. Only thieves and rogues in the modes of passion and ignorance and maddened by material opulence offer a man in sacrifice before the goddess Kali. This is not sanctioned by the Vedic injunctions. Presently, there are many hundreds and thousands of slaughterhouses throughout the world, but that are maintained by a puffed-up population mad for material opulence. Such activities are never supported by the Bhagavat school. Om Agyana Timirandasya Gananjana Shilakaya Chakshur Unmalitam Yena Tasmai Shri Uruve Namaha. I was born in the darkness of ignorance, and my spiritual master opened my eyes with the torchlight of knowledge. And I offer my humble obeisances at his lotus feet and pray that he will enable me to say something beneficial and useful for all of us so that we may all advance on the path of Krishna consciousness. Thank you. How many of us know the full story of Judd Bharat? Have been attending the classes? Okay, not all of us. So what I'd like to do is recap some of the story on how it begins and how it comes to this point. Some of you who already know it will simply know it better to hear it again. In fact, Lord Chaitanya would tell his devotees, read it again and again, and they would read together again and again and again until all of these pastimes were they were as close as your hand is. They were right on the forefront, not in the background or somewhere out there, but they were in the forefront of their minds. And they were always wanting to hear about them, talk about them, think about them, remember them, because they were the all in all. They brought transcendental happiness and joy and satisfaction, and they enabled the person to know the difference between illusion, ignorance, and truth and reality. So that's the value of hearing again and again. So starting from the beginning, if I can remember the whole pastime, Judd Bhadat, before he was Judd Bhadat, he was, as far as I know, King Bhadat. And at a point in time, he decided that he no longer wanted to remain the king. He had a family. He had at least I think 5 or 6 sons, and he had a wife. And so he decided the time had come for him to renounce his kingdom and to go to the forest and begin to begin the process of God realization. So he betook himself to the Gandaki River, which is a very holy river. Does anybody here know why it's so holy, the Gandaki River? The Gandaki River is very holy because actually it is like a tulsi plant. Tulsi Devi manifested herself in the tulsi plant and also in the Gandaki River. So therefore she is extremely holy, and to bathe in the Gandaki River, which is high up in the Himalaya region, is to become blessed. And he wanted to, of course, obtain those wonderful blessings from Tulsi. And so he went to that particular area, and he chanted regularly. He worshipped regularly. He performed certain rituals regularly. The purpose of it was to achieve God realization. To know Krishna, to experience Krishna, to love Krishna, to serve Krishna, to honor Krishna, to always have Krishna in his heart, always thinking of Krishna, so that all other things that he had learned, all other things that he had accumulated would be forgotten. Forgotten in the sense that they were now just excess baggage. Now just excess baggage. The things that he did when he was a king, the battles that he fought, the victories that he had won. Generally speaking, when a person enters an older age, those are the things he or she may think about, his past glories, because he doesn't have any new glories. He's old. So therefore, he needs to reminisce of his past glories, and so he will think about, yes, when he fought this battle and he fought that battle, when he was honored here and honored there, and he was given a medal and given garlands, and the whole kingdom bowed down to him. These are the things that give one a sense of lordship, a sense of glory, sense of greatness. This is what a karmi lives for, dies for, just thrills about, because that's all he has. This is false ego. Real ego is simply the soul. And ideally, the soul in touch with, in connection with, in awareness of the Supreme Lord. But false ego is a fiction. It's a form of amnesia, so to speak. The soul has identified itself with the physical body, mind, and senses, and intelligence. And having identified itself with the body and mind and intelligence, all it wants to do is glorify. It wants to honor. It wants to applaud this body. Because that gives the person a sense of importance, a sense of glory, a sense of greatness. Why did we come into this world in the first place? We came in simply because we wanted to taste what it was like to be a Lord. Krishna was Lord and in the eternal world. Everyone glorifies him. Everyone adores him. Everyone bows down to him. Everyone throws their arms up at him. Everyone says, Jai Shri Krishna. You know, so there, everyone is in love with Krishna. So we have independence. And we also have the sense of curiosity. Even God has curiosity. He had so much curiosity that he manifested himself as Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu in the mood of Srimati Radharani to know what she was feeling. And I'll get into this tomorrow. But anyway, the important thing is that we have independence. And if we use the independence properly, then we use it to serve and love and adore and bow down to and glorify Krishna. But if we don't use it properly and we decide to use it improperly or misguidedly, then we no longer want to serve Krishna. We no longer want to honor him. We want to taste what it's like to be Krishna. What is he tasting? What does it feel like to be Lord? What does it feel like to be honored? What does it feel like to be cherished? What does it feel like to be applauded? What does it feel like to be adored? What's the feeling? We're giving this. We're not getting it. So what does it feel like to be on the other side? So when that curiosity becomes a preoccupation, and that preoccupation then becomes an obsession, one is no longer qualified to live in the eternal world. Because the eternal world is for those who serve and honor and glorify the Lord. It is not for those who want to be a Lord, who want to taste lordship. So when that preoccupation or obsession gets too great, we're no longer qualified to live in that lofty world of devotional service to God. And we are sent to the material world where we can have our curiosity fulfilled. And what is that curiosity? Again, what does it taste like? What does it feel like? What is the experience of being a Lord? So we come into this world, and in so doing, we achieve different professions and occupations. Some of us may become great, and I put quotations on marks, great politicos, maybe a president, you may be a senator, a congressman, a counselor in a city, a governor. You may be, and people worship you, they honor you, they glorify you. And sometimes they throw tomatoes at you also. When they don't like your policies, and when the policies go against their interests, they do throw things. And therefore, we may be that, or we may become a sports athlete, become, you know, a big basketball star, like Kobe Bryant. You know, people are always cheering and honoring and glorifying him, or a major baseball star, or a football star. And because Just think about it. You're in your football star and you're running to make that touchdown and the crowd is roaring and screaming and yelling and finally you're almost about to be tackled but you jump and you dive and you just get over the line and you make the touchdown and the crowd goes mad, crazy, wild, excited. And you have this wonderful feeling that, yes, they're all cheering me. Now I know what it feels like to be a Lord, at least for the 50 seconds that they're cheering. Then the cheering goes down, of course, and somebody else gets it. So everybody gets a chance to be a Lord, you see. Even if you're not a big star, you're a mother, you're a father, you can tell your child, do this, do that. No, don't do it that way. Cross the street on the red light or the green. No, you have to go to school. I don't care. So you are the Lord of that child until he grows up and then becomes your Lord. We don't generally like that. But the important point is that whether you're a big shot or a little shot, everyone can be Lord. Even if you're a dog, when the cat comes by, you bark at the cat and you shoo the cat away. Get out of my property. You know, you're the Lord of the property. And when the cat sees the rat, she goes screaming after it. And when the rat sees the cockroach, he goes screaming after the cockroach. And the cockroach after the ant. And the ant after the mite. And the mite after whatever. The main point is that everyone gets a chance to boss somebody around. And that's why we're here. But it doesn't give any permanent fulfillment. It doesn't give any real satisfaction. You get it, you have it, and then it's gone. After your movie career is over, or your sports career is over, your political career is over, or your mother and father career is over, your kids are grown up, and what have you got? Just memories. What are you doing now? You're not scoring touchdowns. The crowd isn't roaring anymore. All you can do is play those videos of you that you used to watch and spend hours upon hours listening to the roaring crowd when you were then. What kind of a life is that? It's no life. It's an empty life. It's a worthless life. It's a useless life because it's all based upon illusion. And then you die and then you forget it all. The only thing is that you're attached to that same glory, and so you must come back again to do it all over again and again suffer the trials and tribulations and privations and problems and pressures, tensions, stresses of material life. And so it goes on and on, life after life, life after life, misery after misery, sometimes taking an animal body, sometimes taking a demigod body, but in any case or in either case, it is not fulfilling. You get a little pleasure, a little happiness, then followed by much emptiness, vacuity, a worthless life. And you brag, you talk to others about, I did this, I did that, I got so many. Even devotees do that. I say, hey, I distributed 1,000 books today, you know. Like, 1,000? Oh, well, I did 800 today. Oh, well, tomorrow I'll beat you, you know. The 1,000 is for Krishna. It's not for our glory. It's for his glory, you see. So it's just natural. We all have the false ego. And you just don't get it by wanting it to go away. You have to keep working on it. And Krishna gives you realizations to enable it to go away. Coming back to our story. So I just wanted to bring that point that Judd Bodit was a king. So he had it all. He knew what it was to be a lord. He could give it up quite easily. And he did. And he achieved a very high level of bhakti. There are 9 stages in the bhakti yoga process. I'll just repeat them. The first one is faith, when you just get started. The next one is association with devotees. The next one is you get initiated by a diksha guru. The next is you become fixed on the... the next one is that your bad habits begin to disappear. The bad habits, the things that that you did, I mean, even simple things like when you eat, lots of times people, they don't brush their teeth or they don't floss their teeth. They keep all the filth between the crevices of their teeth and it doesn't bother them. But as a person becomes more sensitive and more sattvic, these things, you feel them. And when you feel them, then you don't like them. And therefore, you brush your teeth even after a meal. You floss it. You clean. So, and then you you wash your, so that your mouth feels clean just as before you come to the temple. Your body is clean from, you maybe have been sweating at night when you were sleeping. But so you come to the with a clean body and your mouth is clean. And so the point is this, is that that's just one simple example. Taking a bath regularly. That these, you develop good habits, and so that you don't walk around in such a way that people have to hold their nose when you pass by. So you have good habits develop, your bad habits drop away of being indifferent and being uncaring about your hygiene, your health, and also your mind. You start to keep your mind on Krishna instead of just watching these stupid TV shows such as maybe sitcoms or some of these action adventure shows or all of these things which simply keep you deeper and deeper in illusion. The guy is going after the girl. Will he get the girl? And he experiences this problem, that problem. Finally, you know, at the end, he's going to get the girl. That's generally the way. Or she's going to get the guy. That's the way it works. But until that happens, you know, you're in suspense because there's one obstacle after another, and finally, finally, my hero made it. So this is a waste of time. All the bad motives, lust and anger and greed and envy, illusion, sloth and gluttony, all these wonderful motives are engendered in us when we're watching all of these different. And if you've had them, and we all do, they're exacerbated, they're intensified. So you come here to put them down and to dissolve them, then you go there, and then you expand them. So it's like the boat goes this way, then it comes back and forth. And I know many devotees that have been doing for 20, 30 years, and they feel they can ride on two boats going in two different directions at the same time, but it just doesn't work, and they don't make any advancement. And this is quite pathetic. It's very unfortunate because they're wasting their time by absorbing themselves in these different materialistic novels and movies and different magazines and things which they feel will do them some good. So again, we come back to Bharat Maharaj. Bharat Maharaj, he had achieved, as I said, his faith, association with devotees, initiation, bad habits fall away. Then one becomes steady in his Krishna conscious activities. He doesn't miss. He makes sure he gets his 16 rounds done or 32, whatever he's doing. But he's steady in his worship practices, in his sacrifices, whatever he happens to be doing. He makes sure he observes all the ekadasis. He may even observe the Nirjala ekadasi, which we just had. So he's very steadfast. Another thing is that after he becomes steadfast for a period of time, he develops a taste, the taste for the chanting of the holy name. At first, it may taste like poison because it's just so much sound and you don't feel a connection with the name and a person. But as one chants more and more and more, what happens is that the taste begins to develop. As the ignorance begins to lessen or fall away, then what replaces it is knowledge. And what replaces it also is the joy of the association with Krishna through the chanting of his holy name and through the worship of him and through the devotion to him. So, therefore, one develops a taste. Now, some of us have been here for a few years, and you may have remembered that that which tastes like poison at the beginning will taste like nectar at the end. That which tastes like nectar at the beginning, sense pleasure, will taste like poison at the end. Misery, suffering. An intelligent person does not take part in the sources of misery, which are due to contact with the material senses. Such pleasures have a beginning and an end, and the wise person does not delight in them. What does he delight in? Eternal pleasure, constant pleasure, ongoing pleasure, the pleasure that never deserts us, the pleasure which we're always with, no matter where we are, no matter what we're doing. So then, as I said, you develop taste. And then one becomes fixed on the path of love. That's the next stage. After one becomes fixed on the path of love, it means that he wants to look at Krishna's beautiful face. He doesn't get tired of it. He wants to hear about Krishna's pastimes. Doesn't get tired of it. Whereas earlier, long ago, he would, all right, he lasts for 5 or 10 minutes, and then I got to get out of here. I can't handle this anymore. You know, it's too much. But as we become more and more Krishna conscious, as our heart becomes pure, as the ignorance begins to fade out, like the jaundice, the way you cure jaundice, by the way, is with rock candy. Now, when you taste the candy, when you put the candy in your mouth, you cannot taste the sweetness of it, and that's because the jaundice, which is a bitter taste, covers up the sweet taste. But as the jaundice goes away, then the sweetness becomes prevalent. And when you begin to taste the sweetness of it, then you know exactly what the candy tastes like. Similarly, as a result of our various impurities, we cannot taste the pleasure, the joy, the satisfaction and fulfillment of the holy name. It's just another sound. But as we begin to taste it, we begin to cherish it, we want to embrace it, we know that it is non-different from Krishna. And when it is non-different from Krishna, you know that you're associating with the Supreme Lord. And when you're associating with the Supreme Lord, what could be better, what could be greater, what could be more advanced than that? There is no higher, greater goal than to be associating with Krishna. So that's the next thing. One begins to, he begins to taste, and then he becomes fixed on the path of love. And then after that, love begins to fructify into ecstasy. Ecstasy means that you begin to experience different kinds of ecstatic symptoms. Maybe some of you already experience it. Sometimes you just become overtaken and you just want to jump and hit the ceiling, like this Prabhu over here. He was a foot and a half at least. I didn't have a ruler, but it seemed about that. Yeah, you feel ecstatic. You feel intense love and desire to express that love to Krishna. It could be through singing out loud, or it could be dancing and clapping. It could be sometimes Lord Chaitanya, he would just run around in circles, shouting and screaming, rah, rah, Krishna, like that. So it completely absorbed him, completely overtook him. This was ecstasy. Now, Judd Bharat was on that platform. He was already on that. He was experiencing ecstasy. Now, one day, while he was sitting on the bank of, as I said, the Gandaki River, one day, it chanced that a female, a doe, who was pregnant, was being chased by a lion. And the lion roared, and so the doe, she jumped over the stream, and in the course of doing that, she lost the fawn that she had. So it went into the stream, and the doe, she kind of wobbled into a cave and died. So Judd Bharat saw the poor little fawn. It was floundering in the water. So he got up from his seat and immediately went over to it, and he took it, and he brought it back to his kutir, and he gave it some grass, and he petted it, and he kind of sheltered it. He gave it protection. He gave it his love. Now, that was not something bad. Actually, that was something good, because when a devotee sees that anyone or anything is in danger, the natural response is that you want to give. Love means to relieve someone or something of pain and suffering. So because it means that, therefore he did what was natural to his nature. What was natural to his nature is to save that poor little helpless fawn that would have been killed by the river that was just coursing down. It couldn't swim. It was helpless. So what happened was that little by little, as we know from the story, Bharat Maharaj, he slowly but surely began to fall in love with the little fawn. It was very cute. It was very lovable. It was adorable. You ever see the little eyes of them, and they look at you in such a helpless way? And he was feeding the grass to it. He was petting it. He was rubbing his cheek next to it. And the little fawn would rub his, he had two little it was a male. He had two little tiny antlers which are just there, and he would do this. So he would interrupt the sadhana of, or the meditation of Bharat Maharaj. When he would be trying to concentrate, then he'd feel this little nuzzling against his head or against his shoulder, and then he would hug it and so forth. Anyway, he fell in love with the deer. Now, one may ask, but why should he feel in love? He's already on the ecstatic platform. In that platform, you already have achieved a great degree of detachment. Now, here he is getting attached slowly but surely to this little, beautiful, adorable deer. There was a weakness that he had. This is not often spoken too much about in most of the classes I've heard. But Judd Bharat had a weakness, but had not yet expunged. He had not yet burned it away yet. And what was that weakness? That every man has and every woman has. When you see somebody helpless, you want to give protection. You want to give help. You want to give guidance. You want to give security. Especially a person who was a king, he gave protection to an entire kingdom. He maintained the kingdom. He went out and fought for the kingdom. So he had this feeling of protectiveness towards that helpless little fawn. Unfortunately, he became attached to the fawn, and the result of attachment was that he didn't do what he should have done. When you're attached, you don't want to give something up because you feel that it is useful or helpful or beneficial to your life. And it was actually giving him a pleasure. The same kind of pleasure that his sons used to give him when he was in the kingdom. If you have a son or you have a daughter, they give pleasure to you. You love to watch them when they're starting to walk or when they're trying to make words. You know, they talk like little baby talk. And you're so thrilled by my little son is starting to talk, you know. And then when he cries and you soothe him, there's a pleasure which comes from. Or you give him a little piece of candy. Oh, and now he's so happy. Or you dandle him up and down like this. You turn him up and down. He does somersaults. He spits at you and you don't mind it. He urinates on you. You couldn't care less because you love your little child. It's just a fact. God forbid any other child should do that to you. So anyway, your own child can urinate and defecate on you. That doesn't matter. But another child, that's somebody else. It's not a part, not an extension of your own body. That's the key to it all. Anything that's an extension of your body, you love. But that which is not an extension, which is different, which is diverse, well, that's just something else and somebody else. this feeling of protectiveness, of affection for the helpless, for the insecure, for the doddering. So that took over. And he became so attached to it, to the deer, that he began to worry. If the deer would, a little fawn would walk away and he wouldn't see him, he would wonder, wow, is a wolf going to eat him? Is a lion or a tiger going to grab him? He would be in anxiety, the way you would be if your child kind of wanders out of the house and you can't find him, and you went, oh, what's happened to my child? Where is he? And you go looking. Same thing. He would look. My little. He began to call the deer his son. Ah, my son, you're here. No lion has eaten you. No tiger. No panther. No wolf. No hyena, none of these. I have you, you're still mine. And so this went on and on for a certain amount of time. And then what happened is that, now the question is, what should he have done? Well, as soon as the little fawn could stand on by itself and could eat grass and could pretty much fend for itself, he should have taken it into the forest where all the deer are. And let it mix with the deer community because he wasn't a human being. He was a deer. And deers go with deers and humans go with humans. And birds of a feather flock together. And that's the way it's supposed to be. So he should have done that. And by taking it, the deer, they would have taken care. There were mother deers there. They would have suckled him if necessary. They would take, thousands of deers running all through the forest. He didn't do that because he was too attached to that deer. It was like his son. And who wants to give a son or a daughter away? You just don't do that because you love it. It's a part of your body. Nobody just normally goes and says, hey, I think you're a nice guy. I think I'll chop my arm off here and give it to you as a gift. Would anybody do that? Nobody does that. I think I'll give you my kid as a gift. Nobody does that because you're too attached to it. You love it. You want to coddle it. You want to sleep with it. And that's what he did. So that was his big downfall. When he died, the deer was looking at him with these beautiful eyes, and he died looking at his little deer's face. And all he would say is, oh, my dear, my dear. You can take that two ways, D-E-A-R or D-E-E-R. Either way, it works. So he was saying, my dear, my dear. And then he died. So he died, and the last thought on his mind was his deer. I'm just trying to remember that verse, whoever at the end of his life quits his body, remembering me alone, at once attains my nature. Of this there's no doubt, Krishna says. And whatever state of being one remembers when he quits his body, that state he will attain without fail. And that's what happened. He became a deer in his next life. But he wasn't an ordinary deer. He was a kind of deer who could remember his past life. Krishna gave him that because he was on a very high platform. He was on the bhava stage, the ecstatic stage. And as a result of being on the bhava stage, Krishna gave him the ability to remember his past life so that he would not get over-involved as a deer with the deer. You can't say deers, because deer is a plural and it's also a singular. So he would not get involved with the deer. So what did he get involved with? He remembered his tragedy. He got involved with the sages. The sages in the forest would have their discourses, just like we're having today and as you have every day. And he would sit in the back with his little pores, you know, underneath his forelocks underneath, and he would listen to the different discourses about the glories of God. And in so doing, his mind would be refreshed and revivified with the desire to want to know God, serve God, love God, adore God, and become one with God in love and devotion. So when he died as a deer, what happened was his next birth was in a Brahmin family, because he was doing what the sages do. Hearing about Krishna. So therefore, his next birth was in a Brahmin family. And even though he was in the next birth in a Brahmin family, again, he had remembrance. He didn't forget his past tragedy when he fell in love with the deer. He didn't forget that. And he wanted to make absolutely certain that he would not do that again. And how could he do that? Well, although he was born in a Brahmin family, he had nine brothers. And he had a sister from his father's other wife. This reminds me of Los Angeles temple. Right across the street, we have a hospital. And we have ambulances going every 15 minutes. Actually, when you hear an ambulance, it's a very good way to become Krishna conscious. That could be you. It could be us. We don't know who is in there. And one day, we may be there. So it's nice to utter, just silently and quietly, my dear Lord, please may that person become God conscious. And by doing that, we also in turn become God conscious. Instead of just hearing a siren and being disturbed and upset by the siren, which it is disturbing, it is jarring, it does shake you a little bit. Nonetheless, the result is that you can make it into something positive and useful. Yes. So coming back to the main point of Jad Bharat, the way he would avoid contact with his family is he pretended to be a moron. You all know what a moron is? A moron is a person with a very low IQ and can hardly, he doesn't speak well, he can't understand well, you know, he's very untogether. So he acted kind of like he couldn't hardly see, hardly could hear. He acted kind of like that. His father tried to teach him, to eat with the right hand. He'd eat with the left hand. His father told him that you should wash your hands, you know, after you eat. So he would wash his hands before he ate. He did everything wrong. So he became, to all appearances, he became like hopeless. And that's just what he wanted. He didn't want anyone to think that he was as brilliant, as great, as glorious, and wonderful as he actually was. He wanted people to leave him alone so that he could just chant his mantra and express his love to the Lord through the chanting process. And that's what happened. Now, it just happened that one day, the leader of a group of these dacoits, in India they called them thugs, T-H-U-G, we get our English word, a thug, you know, like a person who's a good for nothing, a person who's could be a crook, he could be a thief, but we call him a thug, you know. So they're called thugs. A thug is a person who does sacrifices to Kali, but the sacrifice is a human sacrifice. And they sacrifice someone who is somewhat on the animal-like plane. So Jadbharat, pretending to be pretty much almost on the level of almost an animal, kind of hardly could speak. So what happened was that the leader of the thugs sent his men out to capture an animalistic-looking man, whom he would then offer in sacrifice. For what reason? The reason was that he would. Does anybody remember the reason that he wanted to do the sacrifice? It was to have a son. He wanted to have a son, so therefore, capture him, offer him to Kali, and chop off his head. The blood comes out, and you offer the blood to her, and she gets intoxicated, supposedly. And then, being pleased by this, she gives you a son. This is the understanding of that kind of person. So they captured somebody, and what happened after they captured him? After the capture, the person somehow he wormed his way out of the ropes and he escaped. So the leader said, "Well, find somebody else." So they found a person who looked a little bit like an animal. Remember, he was full of dirt. He never bathed. Judd bought it. His clothes was old, tattered, rips, tears all over it. He looked like he couldn't care less about anything. He looked as if he might be half animal, half man. So they used him. So what happened was that They bathed him. After they bathed him and they anointed him, then they put fresh clothes on him. And after they put the fresh clothes on him, they brought him into the temple and they put him on a chair. And he was sitting on a chair and they were doing prayers to Goddess Kali. "This is our offering to you, O Goddess. May your thirst for the intoxicating beverage of blood be satisfied. We will give this this animal man to you. May you be satisfied. All glories to you, Mother. All glories to you, Mother. All glories to you, Mother." So he took a sword, and just as he was about to take the sword and cut Jadbharat's head off, that's what's called Jadbharat, as he was about to do that, as it's mentioned here in the last two verses that we were doing, out of that deity form, Goddess Kali burst through in her actual, real, human-like form. And she began screaming and yelling, and she grabbed that sword from that person who was going to cut the head off of Jadbharat and slashed his head off immediately. And then immediately materializing with Goddess Kali were some of her devotees, her disciples, who were all witches. And they came screaming and cackling and yelling, "Ah, blood, blood, blood," you know. And they're jumping and dancing. And Kali went from dacoit to dacoit. It was really a head-rolling session. Heads were just rolling off. And the the disciples, they were screaming in ecstasy, cackling all over the place, and drinking the blood and becoming intoxicated. And they became so intoxicated that they took the heads and they said, "Hey, you take one." And she threw it. The other one took it. "Now you take it." And so they're just passing it around from head to head, from girl to girl, making a big play, making a big game out of the heads. And then finally they just disappeared. Well, Judd Bodett, he didn't particularly like all this, because while the interesting thing about this is that, which I haven't mentioned, while he was waiting and sitting, and they were doing the prayers, readying him to be decapitated, his mood was that, "My dear Lord, whatever you want to do with me, please do. I am your surrendered soul. My life is to be sacrificed to you. So I don't care what happens to me. I only care that you do with me what you want to do with me, because my body, my mind, my intelligence belongs totally, solely, exclusively to you. It's yours. So please, enjoy it. Want to kill me? Good." Lord Chaitanya says that in the Shikshastika prayers. Whether you want to embrace me, you want to kill, embrace me, or you want to kill me, it doesn't matter. I am your worshipable servant forever. I am yours to do what you want to do. So that's a very important principle in Krishna consciousness. To consider one's own body, mind, and intelligence to belong to Krishna. It all is yours, Lord, so you do what you want. So he wasn't worried. He wasn't in anxiety. He wasn't tense. Now that's Judd Bodett. He was in the renounced position. Some of you who may be householders or are planning to be householders, that's not what you do. If somebody comes to attack you or attack your wife or your child, Srila Prabhupada mentions here very clearly in the last purport that I read that you are allowed to fight in self-defense anytime someone is coming to harm your own body, which really belongs to Krishna, or your wife's or your child's. So, therefore, sometimes a devotee can get the wrong idea that, well, he has a wife and a child, but after all, I'm surrendered to Krishna. So what happens? That's Krishna's will. No, his will is for you to protect her, to develop the quality of courage, determination, resolution, and to sacrifice, and also to be unafraid of giving up your body for your wife and child, instead of being attached to it and just enjoying the sense pleasure that your wife may give you or your relatives give you. No, no, no. That's the whole part of it, to sacrifice your body. So a point may be reached. And Bharat Maharaj, when he was a king, he had already done that. He had already done it. He had fought so many battles. He wasn't afraid. He had sacrificed himself so many times, never caring, never worrying, never being anxious about losing his life. He was fearless. He was full of courage. He was bold. He was unswerving in his duty. So, therefore, we must keep in mind the difference between Judd Bodett and those of you who are planning to be householders or planning or already householders. When you become a sannyasi, or a vanaprastha, and you have no longer any family ties, and you have no longer any obligations, and you're giving your life fully to Krishna, well, that's a different matter. Then you have a different dharma. Dharma means your duty. And your duty then is to give your life solely and only to Krishna, who is the owner of it. So that's what happened. Judd Bodett, what he did is he just, seeing all this gore, this gruesome scene, which is not what a devotee wants to look at, he just got up and he just left, and then he would meet very soon another encounter with a great king named King Rahugana, and that's a whole other story. But what I wanted to leave everyone here with is the detachment that Judd Bodett had attained in this third life. First he was Bodett Maharaj, then he was the deer, now he's Judd Bodett. So in the third life, he had attained a very great degree of detachment. No attachment whatsoever for his family. His father, his mother, his brothers had no interest because he didn't want to get so absorbed in family life that you gain pleasures in family life and you want to repeat those pleasures and you want to you remember those pleasures, and at the time of death you come back to that family or another family to do it all over again. He knew he was not going to make that mistake again. And he didn't make that again. And what happened is he reached the last stage of God realization, which is Krishna Prema. That comes after ecstasy. So reaching the last stage, he wandered around the world as a sannyasi, teaching people, stopping at different homes, begging and telling them about Krishna consciousness. So I want to thank you all very much for your kind attention. All glories to Srila Prabhupada ki jai. Srimad Bhagavatam ki jai. And my apologies to all of you for keeping you so late and making you excessively hungry. Isn't it late? I'm over time, right? About 50. Oh, only a little. 5 minutes? Okay. So anyway, I hope you'll all enjoy the prasadam and come to the class tonight. It will be my pleasure again to share these wonderful teachings with you. Anybody have any questions? Okay, there's a question here, please. Well, comments too. You're welcome. We'll get the questions first.
Could be, I'm just trying to frame that question. This material world is an ocean of misery, and we are in the boat.
Talk a little closer.
The material world is an ocean of misery, and by the grace of Guru and Krishna, we have got a boat. We are going in the boat. Maybe it's not smooth, it's going. But you told that we often get caught to become a lord or a boss. Maybe in a book distribution, I've done this much of books, or I've done this much of prasad distribution, or this. So it's a different boat now. We're trying to step in two different boats at the same time.
Talk a little louder. Bro.
We're trying to step in two different boats at the same time.
Yes.
You know, one boat is going this way, one
yes.
boat is going. So our legs are getting stretched.
Yes.
So how to get rid of that boat and be a safe boat? It's not a safe boat. There are so much of many hurdles.
Right.
But still, how to get in that boat?
Right. So the question is how to get rid of the bad boat and stay in the good boat. Isn't that right? The boat that gets you back home, back to Godhead. Well, if you're in the good boat and only the good boat, then if you stay in that boat, it will. But of course, if you're going from one to the other, it won't. So that's the question. How do you stay in the good boat? The important point is you need to reflect and you need to consider and deliberate how the bad boat is harming or hurting your life and preventing you from going forward or advancing in Krishna consciousness. You need to consider the miseries that you're experiencing, and you need to ask yourself, do I like these miseries? Do I want these miseries? Is this something that I want to continue to get? And the answer is no, because we are all meant for eternal, continuous, non-stop bliss. That's our nature. Nobody likes to be in pain. For example, if I take a needle and I start to push it into you, say, ow, ow, stop! Because you don't like pain. Nobody likes pain. So you first have to ask yourself, is the pain worth the pleasure that you get from it? In other words, you get a pleasure and the pleasure turns into pain eventually. Is that pain worth that getting that pleasure? Eventually, you'll come to the conclusion that it doesn't. But the only reason we go for the pleasure is due to previous attachments and affections for that pleasure, which we may have had in our karmic life. Certain tastes that we had, certain smells, certain sounds, certain kinds of stories. Some people I know, they can't stop going to the movies. I know people like that. So when the pain, because I already told why not to, because all the bad emotives come up and then they propel you towards fulfilling those motives, which is more pain and suffering. So you need to discriminate. That's the word that's used in the scripture. Discriminating what is useful from what is not useful. It's mentioned He who discards scriptural injunctions and acts according to his own whims attains neither perfection nor happiness nor the supreme destination. Therefore, one should understand what is duty and what is not duty by the regulations of the scriptures. Knowing such rules and regulations, one should act so that he may gradually be elevated. Okay? So you need to discriminate. And even after discrimination, you may still not. But when the pain, Krishna will continue to pile the pain and misery upon you until you finally reach the point and you say, no more, I've had it, that's it. This is what happened to Bharat. He became a deer and he had to live in a body of a deer. And the other deer were coming around him, you know, the deers, they associate one another. He didn't want anything to do with that. He didn't want a deer life. He wanted a real life that he could finally go back home, back to Godhead. So you need to discriminate. Discriminating means asking, is it worth it? And eventually, if you keep saying, well, maybe, well, yeah, well, a little, finally Krishna will give you such misery, such pain, that you will say, no more, not worth it. And you will remember it because the misery will become so powerful, so strong, so unforgettable. That's why when you go to the eternal world, you never come back to this world, because there's some degree of remembrance which causes you, enables you to never want to lord it over the material world. It just ain't worth it. That's the reason. Is it clear? You have any further question on that? No. Whew. Thank you. Glad. Any other question? Different? Yes, Prabhu. Good and loud. You can get the microphone.
Thank you, Prabhu.
Thank you.
I was wondering, the goddess Bhaja Kali, this is a demigod. She's considered a devotee. The activities that they're doing seem not our usual understanding of devotional activities.
Nice question. when you speak, does that go over your... Do you have like a radio system the way we do in New Dwarka?
It's being broadcast.
It is being broadcast. Television. Wonderful. Yeah, I wanted to be sure. So I don't have to recast your question. It's a good question because Krishna has all kinds of servants. He has servants to do the dirty work and he has servants to do the nice work. He has all kinds. But all service is service. And when it is done lovingly to Krishna, it gets benefit to the servant. Now, in this case, Kali is often used as Prabhupada mentions at the end of the purport, he mentions that it's her service is to get rid of the demons. Now, these demons were about to try and kill, offer in sacrifice, an illustrious, God-loving devotee. Now, Kali and Durga and Maya, they're all in this, that they're in the same family. And their business, of course, is generally to leave the devotees alone, unless Krishna tells them, this devotee is too proud, I want you to make him have a little fall down so he gets rid of his pride. So that's a different situation. But generally, a person like Kali, her business is to, who's going to destroy these dacoits? Who's going to kill them? The good people? The saints, they're not involved with that. They're involved in worship and adoration and glorification and chanting. They don't want to get involved. But Kali, that's her business, to kill the demons. She is a demigoddess empowered to do just that. If any of you have heard the story of Tulsi Devi, there's a big war, and she's on the side of the Vaishnavas, of course. And she eats the demons. You see the picture, I had a book, but you can read about it, my book that I wrote, The Life of Tulsi Devi. So she would go and she would literally swallow them. Well, who would do that except a person who has that particular service to do? And Krishna empowers her, gives her that mode that is necessary to have a taste for blood. It's service. It's like the good guys don't want that service. So somebody's got to do it, so she does it. And it's people who have bad karma. Who's going to give them that bad karma? Krishna uses people who have evil propensities. He's not going to use people with good propensities because that would be a fall. That would be a throwback. Then they would be, in other words, a nice person who's very divine in his characteristics and his qualities is not the kind of person who wants to kill somebody or murder somebody or anything like that. So sometimes Krishna will use a person who wants to murder and use him to murder somebody who has that karmic reaction coming to him. Otherwise, who's going to do it? Or he gets the police, you know, whose job it is to kill for protection. So Krishna uses different persons, and all, in the particular case, as you said, the demigods, their work is generally not killing, but sometimes they get into different battles with the demons, and they do a lot of killing in those battles. So it's not that they're just always lily white, that they don't fight. The battle between the demigods and the demons, actually, they're brothers, half-brothers. They come from Kasyapa Muni and Diti and Aditi. The Aditi, the gods come. Diti, the demons come. And they're always feuding and fussing and fighting. So that's the reason. Is that clear to you, Prabhu?
Yes. I have one just follow-up question. So I was also curious why her associates were witches and female demons.
She has to help them, bring them up. Lord Shiva also has goblins and also quite a few demons and ganja smokers and all these. Who's going to help them? So Lord Shiva, he agrees to not only kill the demons, but he also wants to help those poor goblins and ghouls and vampires and all those kind of horrible situations. So he, by his holy presence, he will stimulate higher, more refined, more sensitive kinds of thoughts. They will come automatically without him preaching to them. It will come just by his presence and when they see the things that he does, you see. So therefore, she brings them up. Right now, they're just, you know, wild, kind of like wild women, you know, crazy wild women. But they'll change. She'll purify them. Remember, because she comes from, she's a devotee at heart. That's the obverse side of Yoga Maya. When you have Mahamaya, you have Durga and you have Kali and all of the different names that she has. And when you have the Yoga Maya, you have Lady Subhadra and some of her different incarnations who only, they will not get involved in that other dirty business. They just, who does Subhadra associate with? Her brother, Krishna. Or anyone like him. And who does she marry? Yeah, Krishna's best friend, Arjuna. And Arjuna, he's a God-conscious person. So they don't hang out with the dacoits and the rogues and the rascals. But that's a service, and somebody's got to do it, you see. It's like we have a sanitation department, and they pick up all those horrible, foul-smelling things. But somebody's got to do it, and so they do it. And it's a benefit to all of us. Because we don't have to do it. So if we don't do it, then okay, we do other jobs. But Krishna gives them those jobs because that's what their proclivity is. That's what the kind of modes they have propel them towards. It doesn't bother them, the smells, so much. There's some people that they smell something foul and disgusting and almost cause you to vomit. It doesn't bother them. And yet a devotee who's so sensitive, even like a half a block away, let's go the other way. You don't want to go there. Okay. Yeah. Any other comment? Yeah, we have a yes? Wait, let's get the microphone so all the devotees can hear it. Thank you. What is your name, Prabhu?
Glenn. Back to Glenn.
Pardon?
Back to Glenn.
Back to Glenn. Yes, go ahead.
Regarding service, why is our service such a joy, and is our service also related to our personality?
The first part is, why is what?
Why is our service such a joy?
Why is service such a joy? Devotional service, you're talking? Devotional service is a joy, is first of all, because Krishna is pleased by it. And when Krishna is pleased by it, and he's in your heart, It's kind of like if you've ever taken a bottle of 7-Up and you shake it a little bit and the bubbles come up. You ever see that? All the bubbles, or if you have the cap off it, how it spurts up. Well, when you do devotional service, even on the lowest level, Krishna is pleased by your service. And he sends into your soul, which then is transmitted to the intelligence and the mind and the body, that pleasure that he has translates or transmits itself in the form of ecstasy or bliss or just plain joy. On the lower levels, just plain simple joy, but as one becomes more advanced, it becomes, you know, bliss and ecstasy with all the symptoms that go with it. So that's why it's devotional service. It's joyful, especially if you're thinking of Krishna when you're performing the service and offering it while you're performing it. Because Krishna sees that you're doing it consciously and that you're aware of him and that you're trying to offer him a present. And anyone who receives a gift feels obliged and wants to give back something. So he gives you back his joy. Okay? What was the second part of your question? The type of service you will do? Is that what you mean? Yes, it is. Prabhupada often used the term that we should dovetail our... the services that we do according to our, he used this word quite often, propensity. A propensity is an inclination. Often can be traced back to your karmic life, the things that you were good at, the things that you were interested in. Some people are musicians. We have a lot of musicians in this movement. Some were musicians, some may have been dancers, some were computer technologists, some were studying law, different devotees. So they went into our legal department. Those who were musicians, they led kirtans and took devotees out on the street. Those who were salespeople, they learned how to distribute books very quickly. So they were dovetailing. To dovetail is to do this. When you put one thing and you tie it to another, they call this dovetailing. When two things connect with one another. So you connect, as you just mentioned, your propensity, you see, to a service. And you transcendentalize it or Krishnaize it by offering it to Krishna. It's not merely selling a book. It's selling a book with the idea of benefiting not only the person who gets the book, but also giving pleasure to Krishna as a result of your effort to see that person become connected with Krishna and thereby be made happy. Krishna is very pleased with that motivation and will then respond. So it really doesn't matter what your propensity is. What really matters is that your heart is flooded with love for Krishna when you do the service. There was a wonderful story of the Brahmin who was illiterate. And when Lord Chaitanya went down to South India, and the Brahmin was there, and he was hardly could read. And he was reading the Bhagavad Gita, He was just hardly making out the letters. And yet tears were flowing down his eyes, down his cheeks. And when that happened, Lord Chaitanya said, "Well, what is making you cry?" He says, "Well," he says, I'm illiterate, I hardly can read." He says, "But I can visualize, I can see that the greatest person on earth, the greatest person all over the universe, came down and became a charioteer. That's a servant job of Arjuna. That is so amazing that it just brings tears to my eyes that someone could be so compassionate, so kind, so loving, so sweet. There, I can't help but crying." So Lord Chaitanya says, "You understand the Bhagavad Gita better than all those Brahmins in the background who are laughing at you." They were laughing mockingly because he was making mistakes while he was reciting the Bhagavad Gita. He says, "They don't know anything except how to pronounce. You know the real meaning and the feeling of the Bhagavad Gita." So the propensity is one thing, but the love that you inject into the service is quite another. And that's what we all have to work on, including yours truly. Okay? So I think all of you want to go to breakfast now. Thank you all very much. I look forward to meeting with you tonight. Hare Krishna.